90.3. This is Near FM.
Aung San Suu Kyi said, "The struggle for democracy and human rights in Burma is a struggle for life and dignity. It is a struggle that encompasses our political, social and economic aspirations." Good afternoon. You're very welcome to International Politics Near 90.3 FM's look at the world of international politics and national politics of international significance. I'm Peter Kearney and I'm with you Tuesday fortnights in the afternoon from 3 to 4:30pm. And on this day, the 7th of May, some significant political happenings. We had the sinking of the Lusitania by the German submarine in 1915. And in the Cold War in 1960, we had the U2 crisis. Excuse me. Significant political birthdays. On this day, the 7th of May in 1892, we had the first president of Yugoslavia, Tito, was born on this day. And in 1919, in Argentina, Eva Perón were all born on this day, the 7th of May. So in this fortnight's International Politics Show, we've a number of different things lined up for you. So in keeping with the opening quote from Aung San Suu Kyi, we have a piece on Burma. It's not about San Suu Kyi herself, but it's about the Buddhist attacks on Muslims taking place in Burma. It's also happening in Sri Lanka, but it's in Burma that we're focusing on. Going to be speaking to Mary Monteau from Burma Action Ireland about that. We'll be talking as well about the attacks on Syria, the reports that Israeli fighters have bombed Syria. So we're going to be talking to Greg Carlson from Al Jazeera about that. And then we're revisiting Guantanamo. We're going to get the opinions of two people, two experts on the area, Michael Ratner and David Cole. So a little bit more from those later on in the show. So if you want to participate in the show and you're local, you can do so by texting us on 087-6944-500. That's 087-6944-500. Or call the station on 867-1190. That's 867-1190. Of course, you can do it if you're not local, except you might be paying an international charge for it. If you want to find myself and you're international, then go onto Facebook or Twitter or the group Meetup and look for either International Politics Dublin or Peter's Politics. You'll find me right there. So, okay, so there's been reports of Buddhists attacking Muslims in Burma, and it's noteworthy because of obviously people are attacking each other and brutalising each other, and also I suppose it's noteworthy because we seem to assume, or at least I assumed, that Buddhism was associated with a certain inner peace and an inner calm, and it's the last group of people that I expected to be involved in such attacks. Now, it's happening in the former British colony of Burma or Myanmar. It has a Buddhist majority and indeed a troubled past between Buddhists and Muslims. The Muslim minority in Myanmar or Burma mostly consists of the Rohingya people. According to Human Rights Watch, the Burmese government has denied citizenship to any Rohingya persons who cannot prove their ancestors settled in the country before 1823. Recent tensions flared up into violent clashes between Muslims and Buddhists in Mictila in March 20th and 22nd 2013, killing at least 40 people and wounding 61. And in April, the BBC provided video footage showing police officers standing by while rioters torched houses and businesses in Mictila. The video showed a brutal killing of at least two people by rioters, which included Buddhist monks. On the 30th of April, 400 Buddhists armed with bricks and sticks overran mosques and torched more than 100 homes in Okan, killing one person and injuring at least nine. The riot reportedly began when a Muslim girl on a bicycle collided with a Buddhist monk. So these are the reports that are out there. So I decided to call on an expert in Ireland, and that's why I called on Mary Monteau from Burma Action Ireland, and Mary's going to tell us a little bit more about the situation.
Mary Monteau, you're the editor of the Burma Action Ireland newsletter as well as being a member of the executive. Of late in the news, we've heard a lot about Buddhist attacks on Muslims in Burma as well as other parts of the world, but we're just focusing on Burma. Maybe if before we get into that, if there's some terminology I'm a little bit confused over. We hear the words Burma, we hear Rohingya, and we hear Myanmar. Maybe briefly, if you could tell us what is the difference between those terms and how would we use them?
Indeed, I can do that with no trouble. In Burma Action and in the Free Burma movement around the world, we still refer to that country as Burma, which was, of course, the title the British gave it and which they accepted as the Union of Burma when they were made independent in 1948. The word Myanmar has a more specific connotation. It refers to a particular ethnic group, the majority, the two-thirds majority in Burma, and they are known either as Burmese or also as Myanmarese. So Myanmar, actually, when they changed the title from Burma to Myanmar, they were essentially implying, we, the Burmese, are in charge of this place. We are the dominant ethnic group. Now, this reflects the fact that there are over 30 different ethnic groups inside Burma. Most of them, obviously, much more of a minority than the Burmans, but they are, many of them, very unhappy to be ruled over in this emphatic way by Burmese people. The Rohingya refers to a particular ethnic minority of Burmese people. These are a minority that live in the far west of Burma on the Bangladesh border in a state called either Arakan, the old name, or Rakhine. Now, this state has traditionally had the main Muslim population of Burma in it. These people have been living in that area on that border for centuries. Unfortunately, they have, of recent years, become the target of government prejudice and what we used to call Burmaization. Burmanization was a government policy to make everybody conform to Burmese within Burma. And so they prevented schooling in the native language, and they actually, in 1982, took away the citizenship of the Rohingya minority, which is a Muslim minority. Okay. The Rohingya people since then have been persecuted in many ways. Special laws have been made for them, which mean that they cannot travel, and then that they could not marry without permission, and all sorts of very serious prejudicial arrangements were made specially for them. Many of them started to flee. People have been coming out from Arakan in fear of their lives for over 10 years. The Bangladeshis, as you know, Bangladesh is one of the poorest countries in the world, have had a problem, obviously, with quite large flows of refugees out of Burma, essentially driven out by the Burmese army. And nowadays, I'm afraid, the Bangladeshis quite callously often drive the Rohingya minority people back into Burma and back into the arms of the Burmese army. So that's the old background for the poor Rohingya minority. Nowadays, just in recent times, since last June, there has a major flare-up, which is described as a religious flare-up between Buddhists and Muslims. But I want to assure you, although that's the most recent face of it, it's quite clear that the Burmese government, the new supposedly civilian government in Burma, is not only tolerating but actually facilitating a lot of the attacks on Muslim people in Arakan.
Okay, so with those three terms that we have, Burma is what is accepted as an international legal term, yet within that the people of Rohingya are, and other groups are not necessarily happy being part of the Burmese state, is that correct?
Yes, well, they would be quite happy, I think, if the Burmese state hadn't been ruled exclusively by the Burmese army since 1962.
Okay, all right, so they're happy enough within it, it's the treatment of the government.
So essentially, I think what you have to realise is that Burma is a very extraordinary place. In a general way, the people are very kindly, very family orientated, and the ethnic minority groups for many, many years would have lived in a sort of kind of loose harmony. Uh-huh. The Burmese, it's not been an issue. But once large amounts of development, as the government likes to call it, started to appear in the form of wanting to pump natural gas, to pump oil, all these big earners, and also hydroelectric, then effectively the Burmese army became involved in trying to drive ethnic minority peoples out of the areas where they wish to develop.
Is that what is at the root of the current conflicts in Burma? Because what we hear it over is that there's Buddhists attacking Muslims and we're not really sure why.
No, and indeed I don't think the Buddhists themselves would really exactly know why. There has been quite deliberate fomenting of unrest. I just better let you know that Arakan and the Rohingya are not, that's not the only area of ethnic minority conflict in Burma.
Okay.
There are serious conflicts in three other areas. There's one with people in the north part of Burma, or further north and east, who are called the Kachin.
Uh-huh.
They've been fighting the Burmese army ferociously for nearly 2 years now because of the Burmese army plans to take them out of their villages and build a gas pipeline.
Okay.
The Karen people are fighting because of the Burmese army trying to get them out of their lands in order that the Chinese can build hydroelectric dams on their river, which is the Salween, where they live. And the Kachin are Christian people, largely, and many of the Karen are also Christian, so that those things can be put in terms of a religious conflict. Indeed, that has been said.
Mm.
But the basic underlying motive, I believe, is always the same. That is that the Burmese army and the government are very interested in money,
mm-hmm.
in getting as rich as they can personally.
Yes.
Before the recent elections, the old dictator who stood down is one of the richest men in the world.
Mm.
And when his daughter married, she was wearing a bridal gown totally encrusted with diamonds.
Right. Now, how would the current dispute help increase their wealth?
Well, they're doing it in every possible way. They obviously have the idea that they have all the land rights in Burma.
Mm.
So they are pushing peasants all over Burma, pushing them off their land. This is land that's been farmed by these people for centuries, and this is not ethnically motivated. It is quite simply that the potential for development in that particular area, it has attracted attention.
Okay.
So we have reports of people being displaced and no compensation being offered, all over Burma. And again, I want to just emphasize, this is not new. This is the way that the Burmese government, ever since it became a military government in the 1960s, has behaved towards its own population.
Okay. And
we call it state terrorism.
State terrorism. Okay. And the current dispute, the current attacks, it's Buddhists against Muslims, but really it's irrelevant. It's, as you say, it's the state's desire to control more land where the Muslims happen to be living.
Yes, partly that. I think the situation for the Rohingya is slightly different from any of the other ethnic minorities.
Okay.
Because they alone have been disenfranchised completely and told that they're not really Burmese. In fact, in today's news from Burma, I was just reading that entire villages are now being, they're being told by Burmese army officials that they must take fake Bangladeshi passports. And
okay.
go.
Okay.
And these villages are trying, obviously, not to do that. Now, we regard this as a form of ethnic cleansing. I don't think that there's really ethnic cleansing as such going on around the major development sites that are so interesting to the Chinese. But I do think that it can be called ethnic cleansing for the Rohingya because it's quite specifically targeted against the Muslim minority. And I think that what's happening with the Buddhist monks is they have got swept up into the rhetoric that the government puts out on this stuff.
Okay, so the Buddhist monks, in effect, are a pawn that the government are using to carry out their work to clear out those areas.
Yes, but I also want to say, I mean, Burma is in many ways, is a very religious society. That is, that the monks are a very, very important part of their society.
Yeah.
And most of the boys will have learned to read and write, indeed the girls as well, in monasteries and so on. So one way or another, the integration of the Buddhists and the Buddhist monasteries in with the life of the people in Burma is very, very intimate.
Mm.
The result of this is that for a very long time, including rising against the British, Buddhist monks have led the people against their enemies.
Mm.
There's a long tradition of that, and we've seen that ourselves in the Saffron Uprising.
Right.
That was one of the most spectacular examples of what almost a Burmese feature, I suppose, in history, that the monks at certain times come out from their monasteries and lead the people, but it's usually peaceful.
Yeah.
What is extraordinary about what's going on in Arakan is that the Buddhist monks and the Buddhist crowds are so violent.
What do you know of this group calling itself 969?
Well, this is, again, there's a little of Burma culture in this.
Mm.
Burma is a very has a lot of numerology. I don't know if that word means much.
Yes,
it's kind of astrological significance of numbers.
Yes,
969 is taken to be a very, very significant number for Burma and for domination. And they believe that this is the time. Therefore, this is astrologically the time to go for it, as it were. Okay. On the other hand, I believe the Burmese Muslims have a different number, and they believe that their number is equally important. Mm. This is quite a curious, it's quite a curious set of beliefs, but it's very, very prevalent. Again, I can tell you that no ruler in Burma would ever go very far without having consulted his astrologer.
Really? Okay, so it's considered that important. But this particular group called 969, on some sites, some people have described them as neo-Nazi Buddhists.
I think that's unfortunate. There's no parallel with Western thinking at all, I think. The Nazis had a certain kind of a theory, and I don't think there's any parallel to that in Burma. What there is in Burma is a lot of poverty and discontent, which has not changed, because the same people are still in power as were there before the so-called election.
Yes. Okay, so bringing it back to the government then, you said the same people are still in power. Other news that we have heard from Burma of late, and that was the big news, a big good news story, I suppose, was the visit to Ireland of
Aung San.
Yes, exactly. I mean, is this in any way related, or is this, I mean, the government tactics here, is it in any way connected to that, or... does she have a position on this matter, or does it have any relevance to her whatsoever?
Yes, I think one has to say that it has a lot of relevance to her. What has happened in Burma has placed her in a very, very difficult place. Hmm. She was confined, as you know, for years and years and years in her house and unable to have an effective political presence after she won the original election. So what then happened in that period of nearly 20 years was, of course, that many of her colleagues were old, and the students were sent out of university, the universities were closed. She was under house arrest all this time.
Mm.
She is the daughter of General Aung San, who was the man who brought Burmese independence from the British. So she has a status which is extraordinary in Burma.
Mm.
She is both very, very significant and actually almost powerless.
Right.
So she has this iconic presence, and she, well, obviously the military would never have hesitated to kill her if they thought they could get away with it. But because she is the daughter of General Aung San, the father of Burma, they never dared to do that. They never dared to kill her, though they tried. Mm-hmm. We know of several assassination attempts, but they never succeeded, and they never actually had the courage to carry it through.
Mm-hmm.
So when the new constitution of Burma was finally forced through by the old dictator General Than Shwe. It included the complete perpetuation of the rule of the military. That is, the military has 75% of the seats.
Yeah.
In the Burmese parliaments, the top brass were encouraged to civilianize themselves, take off their uniforms, and stand for election, which is exactly what they did. President Thein Sein actually was one of the top generals, as I'm sure you know.
Yes.
So we call this a pseudo-civilian government. However, there were 25% of the seats which were available to real civilians, and of course Aung San Suu Kyi's party won a number of those seats. The total of seats, I think, was about 44, which were non-government as such. Because of her prominence, she has effectively been in this extremely ambiguous position. She had either to oppose the government, in which case her voice would be almost nothing, or to try and work with it.
Nice.
She's a very passionately constructive thinker, and she has tried to work with the government. At one point, in fact, early on, when she was having frequent meetings with the new president, she thought she could trust him. However, events have shown that that was a mistake. And just on Friday, she has been to meet Muslim leaders to express her concern for what is happening in Burma.
In wrapping it up, would it be fair to say, if you can wrap up such things, that what's happening is, like so many other conflicts in the world, it's not necessarily about religion. It's not that people are disputing another person's philosophy or another person's book, but the religion is being used in order to acquire certain lands for certain resources.
I do believe that entirely, Peter. That would be my own personal view. And I think that, incidentally, the superstitious nature of the people makes them vulnerable to what is rhetorical leadership from religious people. Mm. I do think that, yes.
Now, Reuters say that Israel has carried out an airstrike targeting consignment of missiles in Syria bound for Hezbollah and neighbouring Lebanon, an Israeli official said on Saturday. The Jewish state had made it clear it prepared to use force to prevent advanced weapons reaching Lebanon's powerful Shiite Muslim guerrillas from Syria. On Saturday, Israel dropped massive bombs near Damascus, ones which the New York Times, quoting residents, originally reported resulted in explosions more massive than anything the residents of the city have witnessed during more than 2 years of war. The Jerusalem Post quoted a senior Syrian military sources claiming that Israel used depleted uranium shells, though that is not confirmed. The New York Times cited a high-ranking Syrian military official who said bombs struck several military facilities in some of the country's most tightly secured and strategic areas. Well, it's very difficult really to know exactly what is happening in a conflict like this. And on top of that, we have what is pretty much a civil war in Syria going on in the background. So I contacted a few people to see if they could tell me what was going on. And I came across a Greg Karlstrom from Al Jazeera, who knows the area pretty well. So I decided to ask him to see if he could tell us a little bit more about what exactly is going on in the region.
I mean, we're talking about the Israeli attacks on Syria. Just as a brief introduction, can you briefly tell us what happened there, or what is alleged to have happened there, and what do you believe the implications are of that?
Sure. I mean, what's alleged to have happened is the Israelis, they carried out two different sets of airstrikes over the weekend. One of them was near the Damascus airport, targeting what was allegedly a shipment of advanced missiles that were being sent from the Syrian military to Hezbollah in Lebanon. And the second set of attacks the following night targeted three different facilities around the Damascus area. The details on exactly what were hit are a little bit sketchier on those attacks, but there was a military research facility that was hit. It's believed that the headquarters of, or a base of the Republican Guard was hit, and then also supposedly a Syrian anti-aircraft defense site near Damascus was hit as well.
Okay, so these were very specific targets that were targeted and hit. There weren't just places that were hit at random. Okay, so if it's Israel that's done this, and that's what the reports were hearing, that it is, that's Israel that has done this, what is in it for Israel? I mean, obviously nobody wants war, but particularly now, how will that serve anybody's interests, escalating this into an international war?
Well, I think the calculation for them is that it's not going to really escalate into an international war. For them, this was, again, they went after very specific military targets were allegedly being sent to Hezbollah. In the case of the missiles that were hit, these are allegedly Iranian-made missiles that are fairly precise and can be launched essentially from anywhere. You can put them on the back of a pickup truck and launch them from anywhere and have a range that would cover, it's about 300 kilometers, so it would cover, if they were fired from southern Lebanon, the vast majority of Israel. And so they viewed these as sort of, I mean, they call them a game changer, to use the cliche phrase. These are missiles that could be fired from anywhere at strategic targets within Israel, at military bases, at the runways at Israeli Air Force bases, things like that, and could hit them with a degree of precision. So they went after these specific targets. I think their calculation is that because they're only going after these weapons that are allegedly being sent to Hezbollah and not going after necessarily the Syrian army, Assad is not going to escalate and is not going to respond.
Okay, so it's not an attack on the Assad regime. It's an attack on rockets that could be going to Hezbollah, and that could potentially damage or endanger the security of Israel.
Right, and the Israelis came out today. A senior member of Likud, of the governing party, came out today and essentially said, we're only going after Hezbollah. We're not going after the Syrian regime. And I think that was, he said that on army radio in Israel. It was clearly a message meant for the Syrian government that we're not going directly after you.
Okay.
So I think that was an attempt on their part to convince the Syrians not to retaliate and to give them some degree of comfort, I guess, that Israelis are not going after Assad's army.
Yes. Nonetheless, it is an infringement on sovereign Syrian territory. So might the Syrian government interpret it as such and strike back? I mean, is it likely that Syria would hit back at Israel?
It doesn't seem like it. I mean, they put out a couple of very harsh statements yesterday, obviously, which seemed like they were for domestic consumption for the most part.
Okay.
But I think the calculation for the Syrians right now is that to retaliate runs the risk of escalating this and prompting an even broader Israeli retaliation. And with the Syrian army already stretched fairly thin, I think their calculation is that they can't afford to take the risk of an Israeli response. You know, certainly something like if the Syrians were to send planes to bomb some target in Israel, that would run the risk of the Israeli Air Force then coming in and severely damaging the Syrian Air Force, which they're relying on to fight the rebels right now. So I think their calculation is that they can't respond because it runs the risk of their army being seriously degraded.
Okay. Now, these weapons that are allegedly being transported to Hezbollah, I mean, so this transportation then obviously had nothing to do with the Syrian conflict. Was it taking advantage of the fact there's a conflict in Syria that such weapons could be sent through without anybody detecting them?
Yeah, I mean, I think the talk in Lebanon, I was there last week, and obviously it's hard to find out from Hezbollah what they're doing. It's a very closed organization. It's very hard to talk to anyone from the organization. But yeah, the sense there is that they're trying to, like you said, take advantage of the chaos and the confusion to get weapons across the border. And they're also trying to stockpile in anticipation that if Assad falls, if there is some regime that replaces him that is less amenable to Hezbollah, that they want to stockpile advanced weapons before that happens, because they might then lose their ability or have a harder time smuggling weapons through Syria, depending on who takes power after Assad.
Okay. So this particular incident, it's really damaged Hezbollah more than it's damaged. I mean, it could very well happen, obviously, depending on the slant that's put on it, but it could very well have no effect on Israel or the Assad regime, and Hezbollah are the ones who've been damaged by it in both senses.
Right, exactly. I mean, they lose their ability to import these advanced weapons. The Israelis, I think, don't think Syria will respond, and Syria, I think, doesn't want to respond, doesn't want to take the risk of responding. So okay. I think on both of their parts, they're going to let this blow over.
Okay. Now, it's not really clear, well, not completely clear anyway, as to whether the US had advance warning of this. Do you think this is something that would have to be cleared in whatever way these things are cleared with the US before it took place, the strike on the alleged strike on Hezbollah?
You know, I've heard both arguments, and it's really hard to say. I mean, on the one hand, you would think that Israel would at least give the US a little advance notice. But given that the US doesn't seem to want to get involved in Syria, given that up until this point Barack Obama doesn't want to seem to involve the US in the Syrian civil war, you could also say that maybe he wants to preserve plausible deniability. And so maybe he told, I've heard from American officials, from also Israeli officials, that when he was in Israel in March, he essentially told Netanyahu, like, you have a free hand to do what you need to do to protect what you perceive as Israel's security, and sort of gave him blanket permission to do things like this in the future without giving the U.S. advance notice.
Tune in to Balkan Beats on Near FM every Thursday from 3:30 to 4:30 p.m. for the best of Balkan news, recipes and music, both new and old, with me, Lidija Radačić. Slušajte Balkan Beats na Near FM svakog četvrtka od 3:30 do 4:30 popodne. Za novosti, recepte te najbolju muziku s Balkana, staru i novu, slušajte Balkan Beats s Lidijom Radačić.
For an independent voice on international politics and world affairs, tune in to International Politics every Tuesday fortnight from 3:30 to 4:30 p.m. with Peter Carney. Heard voices, the challenging of conventional opinions, and a diversity of opinions related to world events. That's International Politics every Tuesday fortnight from 3:30 to 4:30 p.m. with Peter Carney on Near FM.
Holidays, cars, home improvements and loans at attractive rates on a reducing balance. Other services include ATM, bill pay, salary scheme, foreign exchange. Just some of the services available at Coolock Artane Credit Union. At the Artane Roundabout, we're open Tuesday, Wednesday and Saturday from 9:30 until 4:30, Thursday from 10 until 4:30, and with a late night on Friday until 8 p.m. Also at the Northside Shopping Centre, we're open Tuesday, Wednesday, Friday and Saturday from 9.30 until 4.30, with a late night on Thursday from 10am until 8pm. Phone Artain on 851 3400 or Northside Shopping Centre on 851 3450. Phone alone at 1890 285626 or log on to the website at www.cacu.ie.
Text 087 69 44 500.
90.3. Near FM.
And you're welcome back to International Politics with Peter Carney, here every Tuesday fortnight from 3.30 to 4.30pm. Again, if you want to participate in the show, you can do so by texting us on 087 6944 500. That's 087 6944 500. Call the station directly on 867 1190 or go on to Facebook, Twitter, Meetup, whatever it might be, and find me there under International Politics Dublin or Peter's Politics. You can find me at one of those. So again, before the break, thank you very much to Mary Monteau from Burma Action Ireland and to Greg Carlstrom from Al Jazeera for those reports. Okay, so last week, or last fortnight I should say, on the show we featured Guantanamo and we spoke to the International Red Cross about their positioning on the force feeding of some of the hunger strikers at Guantanamo. The men being held at Guantanamo have been basically in limbo for over 12 years since... close to 12 years, I believe it was 2001, 2002 when Guantanamo was open. More than half the detainees have been deemed innocent, but Obama, despite the election, or what he promised in the election, his first election campaign, has refused to release them. All 166 inmates in Guantanamo have reached such a level of hopelessness, it's said, that almost all of them have decided to end their own lives by doing so. So this is part of the recent hunger strikes. Indeed, there have been a number of hunger strikes since Guantanamo opened in 2001, 2002. But the recent hunger strikes begun in February of this year. And as we discussed with the International Cross 2 weeks ago, they're once again on hunger strike, and the International Red Cross have let their protestations known about the American government's decision to force feed some of these people on hunger strike. Now, Michael Ratner of the Centre for Constitutional Rights, he's also the US lawyer for Julian Assange. He has represented some of the inmates in Guantanamo and in the detention camp. So as I spoke to the International Red Cross, I thought I'd speak to somebody who was had closer contact with the guys there. And in this interview that I did with him over the weekend, he drew some comparisons between Guantanamo and the hunger strikes in Guantanamo and, of course, the hunger strikes in Ireland in the early 80s.
You're the President Emeritus of the
Centre for Constitutional Rights.
Okay, and US lawyer for Julian Assange. And the Centre, you've been, your Centre's been representing inmates in Guantanamo.
Right. In fact, I started the first case in 2002.
Okay.
For the English guys and the Australian, you know, Razul and then Hicks.
Okay. All right, great. In your opinion, and for the people that you're representing, do you believe they're being held there illegally?
Oh, yeah, there's no question about it. I mean, when we started in 2002, we thought the whole system was illegal. I mean, I sort of was shocked. I was sitting in the same office, and I saw the president issued a military order that said he could pick up any person anywhere in the world, take them to a place like Guantanamo, hold them indefinitely, never try them. And if he tried them, he's going to do it by a rump military commission. Mm-hmm. So there was no system of law like that. We either have a criminal law system or we have a system under the Geneva Conventions. Mm-hmm. I favored a criminal law system. He favored a military system. But even then, he didn't go for the Geneva Conventions. He just set up a third system, which I guess would be familiar to people in Ireland from your wars a few years ago.
Yeah. So internment without trials. You just pick people up and throw them in prison.
Yeah, that's what it is. And, of course, that was perhaps an example. How you guys ever ended it, I don't know. But we're not about to end it. And, of course, you had Bobby Sands die,
yeah,
maybe to end it.
Yes.
And maybe that helped. But we're at that situation now. I haven't looked at the evidence lately. But, you know, at one point, there was an English journalist, I guess Steve Gray was his name.
Okay.
I can't remember. Who charted a lot of those tail numbers of flights that went in and out of various airports in the UK and other places. And I can't recall now whether Shannon was one, but as I recall, it was.
Yeah.
But I don't have it right in front of me.
So in your opinion, and I guess I already know the answer to this question, but I'll ask it anyway. Do you believe that it's in the interest of US security to hold people in Guantanamo?
You know, even Obama, to the extent he speaks about it, says it's not in the interest of security to hold people in Guantanamo. I certainly don't believe it's in the interests, but all you have to do is listen to our own president, who in 2009, when he was elected, said it wasn't in our interests. Gave a speech in 2009, said it's against our security interests. Yeah. People don't like us for it. They may even become anti the United States and create acts of terrorism because of it, et cetera. And then he gave the same speech last week, where he again said it's not in the U.S. interests. Mm. So the question we have to ask ourselves is, why are they continuing to hold people there? Why is Obama pretending he has his hands handcuffed and can't move? So there's some reason they're keeping it open. Mm. Unclear to me what it is, other than Obama being weak-kneed and it being sort of a place that people can kick around and say, oh, we're holding these people.
Yeah. Yeah, that's been one of the puzzling things from over here in Ireland and in Europe. People who held out so much hope for Obama, one of the main things within his pre-election speeches was that he was going to close Guantanamo within a year. That obviously hasn't happened. Now, for some reason, he's bringing it up again. Why is he bringing it up at this time? Why is he saying that he's going to do all he can to close Guantanamo?
Well, you know, he not only said he would close it in 2008 and 2009, he actually signed an executive order, which you obliquely referred to, that said he would close it in a year. Hmm. Then he proceeded not to close it. He proceeded to act weak-kneed, not take the people into the United States that he could have. Then Congress got in the act and started fiddling around with it. And then Obama continued not to stand up to Congress or the national security establishment. Mm. And it was dead. To be honest, 90 days ago, when it was about when the hunger strike began at Guantanamo, I thought it was done. I thought we were finished. I thought it was flat. We had no media, no press. Obama had closed the office in the State Department that was going to close Guantanamo, and it was done. And then what happened is, in our most low moment for us, for the inmates, for the detainees, they went on a hunger strike. And it's grown and grown and grown. And it's over 100 people of the 166 left in Guantanamo are on the hunger strike. Mm. And that, I think, has forced it onto the front page again. It forced Obama to give that, really what I would have to call BS speech he gave last week about the national... it's in the security interest of the United States to close it.
Yeah.
And that, I say it's BS, is he gave this speech, all these reasons it should be closed, and then he says, I will work with Congress to close it. Well, Congress is hopeless on this.
Yeah.
But Obama has the authority to transfer people, even under the so-called restrictions that the Congress has put on him.
Yeah.
He can transfer people by just signing a note saying, I waive all the restrictions and I transfer them in the national interest of the United States. But he didn't even suggest that in the speech, and he hasn't done it.
Yeah.
So it's really an outrage.
Yeah. Now, is that the thing you think it's the transfer? He can transfer these people, but where will they be transferred to?
86 of those people, half, are from Yemen. Yemen will take them all.
Okay.
So he can transfer half the people to Yemen. Of those 86... even my own government, the United States, has actually cleared 55 of them for release. Think about that. 55 people from that 86 that go to Yemen are cleared for release. Over half of the people have been cleared for release.
Hmm.
That means there's been people there 11 or 12 years who are not guilty of anything,
hmm.
who even my own government says shouldn't be there, shouldn't be in prison, should be out.
Yeah.
And
so
they're being held at Guantanamo because we have a president who is basically a do-nothing president on this issue. It's just an outrage.
Yeah,
and the next thing that happens on that is the hunger strike. So you have a hunger strike, 100 people on a hunger strike. And I'm sure you're familiar with this.
In fact, where
the law was established was in Ireland with Bobby Sands. A person has a right, like I do, to decide they're not going to get any medical treatment, to decide X and Y and Z. I also have the right to decide I'm going to go on a hunger strike and I can't be force-fed. And that's the law. That's what our American Medical Association has said. And yet they are force feeding the people in the most tortuous way in Guantanamo.
Yeah. Now, we spoke about this on the show last week, that they were being force fed and the International Red Cross have condemned it. Is that in some ways, why are they force feeding them? Are they trying to buy time or hoping that the inevitable doesn't happen, as in somebody will die and then that's going to escalate matters?
I think two reasons. I think one is the feeding is done in a tortuous manner with a large tube that's stuffed down through the nose. Like people say, it feels like a razor blade into the stomach, et cetera.
Uh-huh.
Perhaps you discussed it last week. So one reason is to break the hunger strike as they did before, a few years ago, by very, very cruel forced feeding.
Yeah.
So I think that's one way. I also think to the extent I've spoken to people who were involved with Bobby Sands' case, that that actually changed the nature of the debate in the UK, that it made a difference when he died. Unfortunately, it took his death to make that difference. Yeah. And I think they fear that. You start losing some people from hunger strike, and then Obama isn't going to be able to sit there and pretend his hands are tied.
Yeah.
So I think they want to avoid that result.
Yeah. Now, you said he's been weak-kneed. He's a do-nothing president on this particular issue. Is he trying to keep certain elements of the right happy by not sending people home or by not closing it?
You know, I would like to say it's elements of the right, but the votes in Congress to put all kinds of restrictions on closing Guantanamo and restrictions on transferring people to the United States... Majority right, yes. Majority Republican, yes. But many, substantial number of Democrats went along with it. Mm-hmm. So this, unfortunately, is a issue that people say, oh, you see, I'm tough on terrorism. Everybody fears Guantanamo. You know, they've been taught for 10 years, 12 years now, that the Guantanamo are the worst of the worst, even though the evidence shows they're not at all. And in fact, the U.S. has cleared them. So I don't think it's just about the right. I think Democrats also, as long as they get, it's an easy target.
Mm.
They have no constituency in the United States, the people at Guantanamo.
Yeah.
You know, first, they're at Guantanamo. Secondly, they're Muslims, which have almost no constituency here.
Yeah.
Third, they're like painted as the other. Yeah. And so it's an easy way to get votes and kick on people. And,
right.
And Obama won't buck it. And he should have bucked it originally. He won't buck it today.
Mm.
He won't buck it tomorrow. And he may only buck it when we finally get what we're getting there is Guantanamo detainees saying, it's enough already. We're taking our lives in our own hands. We are going to control our fates.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very important and moving moment for me, and I think for everybody who's followed Guantanamo.
Michael Ratner, the President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Great stuff. So pretty harsh words there from Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights and the US lawyer for Julian Assange. Certainly didn't mince his words about Obama and the position that he's taken on Guantanamo. So he got straight to the point on that. So it is one of those issues, one of the many issues that people are really scratching their heads over as to why the 166 inmates are still in Guantanamo, given the fact that it was promised, a pre-election promise in the 2008 campaign that it would be closed, yet it still remains open and nobody seems to be going anywhere just at the moment. But we'll see, as they say, nothing quite concentrates the mind quite like an execution. Will the hunger strikes concentrate the mind in that particular way? We'll have to wait and see. If someone were to die, then that certainly would change things. I don't know. But at the moment, it doesn't look like that's likely because some of those on hunger strike are being force-fed, which is, as we said 2 weeks ago, received much criticism from the International Red Cross Committee. So we'll wait and see. President Obama's comments recently, and this was the thing that triggered it for me, is why I wanted to feature it this week again. It was Obama's recent comments, in that I really had heard almost nothing from him on the issue, and it was, as they say, it was near silence on the issue from the time of the pre-election campaign, from when he was first elected until now. And then out of nowhere, it was Tuesday, I think it was this day last week, he spoke about it again. Now, his comments last week on Guantanamo were apparently in response to a question from a reporter about the prison, where Obama responded by saying that Guantanamo was not sustainable and it is contrary to who we are. Some days earlier, Vice President Biden said he thought the Senate Select Intelligence Committee as yet unreleased 6,000 page report on the CIA's enhanced interrogation program should be made public. So there's a lot of noise being made about it at the moment, yet again. And after such a long period, as I said, of near silence on the matter, Obama has spoken out again. But why now? What has changed, or has anything changed? Well, to get another opinion on the matter, I decided to speak to somebody who wasn't necessarily directly involved with it, David Cole, Professor of Law at Georgetown University Law Centre. So I caught up with him and I asked him about the situation as well in Guantanamo. And what is it that may have prompted Obama to speak about it this time around? So this is David Cole, from Professor of Law at the Georgetown University Law Centre.
In recent days, this week, Obama has said again that he would like to close Guantanamo. Now, he said it originally in his presidential campaign when he was elected the first time round. Why do you think he's talking about it now? It was the big thing for us that Obama was going to close Guantanamo, and it was one of the many weaknesses that people see in his presidency, that it hasn't been closed yet. For some reason, he's bringing it up now. Is it because of the hunger strikes, or what is his motivation, do you think?
Well, I think it probably is because of the hunger strikes. He brought it up in response to a question from a reporter during a press conference, so he didn't really control. He had to say something.
Uh-huh.
But he didn't have to be as loquacious as he was, and he didn't have to be as strong in what he said as he was. I mean, his remarks were extraordinarily strong. He sounded almost like a spokesman from Human Rights Watch speaking. He says it's not sustainable, it's not consistent with our character, it must stop. We have to ask ourselves, what are we doing holding people for this long, etc. So I think what that reflects is that this is a president who sincerely wants to close Guantanamo, and I think it increases the pressure on him to show some progress in that regard.
Okay, so why has he waited till now? I mean, why is 4 to 5 years passed before it? He said he would have it because everybody knows. He said he would have it closed within his first year. Why has it taken him so long? Why is he dithering on it, or why is he avoiding it?
Well, I don't know if I'd say it's dithering. I think what he did was, on his first day in office, he promised to close Guantanamo. It then turned out, in attempting to make good on that promise, that it's much more difficult than it sounds. There are 166 people there today. Many of them can't be returned to the countries from which they came because of concerns that they would be tortured there, and it's not easy to find other countries who are willing to take them. Others are there pending ongoing military commissions. Still others have been determined to be not subject to trial, but to be sufficiently dangerous and linked with Al-Qaeda that they can't be released. So closing Guantanamo is difficult on its own terms. And then on top of that, Congress came in and said and put incredible restrictions on his ability to do anything to make progress toward closing Guantanamo. They barred any transfer of a detainee into the United States for any purpose. And that would be necessary to close Guantanamo. And they put very onerous certification restrictions or requirements on his transferring to any third country. And since then, basically transfers have dried up.
Okay. But is it not true that there's a number of detainees in Guantanamo? I think that if you were to single out one country, I believe Yemen has the greatest number of inmates, if you can call them that, in Guantanamo. Hasn't Yemen indicated that it's willing to retake those people?
Well, there are 86 people at Guantanamo of the 166 who the Obama administration has cleared for release. That means that the military and the security services and the FBI and have all agreed these people do not need to be detained. They don't pose any threat to the United States. 56 of those are from Yemen. And we were preparing to return them to Yemen when a couple of years ago the underwear bomber, the man who tried to detonate explosive in his underwear while flying into Detroit, Michigan on Christmas Day, he was from Yemen. The plot emanated from Yemen, and that caused concern that the Yemeni government was not sufficiently stable to assure that if we returned these individuals to Yemen, they would not pose a continuing threat to us in the future. That's the claim with respect to the people from Yemen.
Okay. Now, a number of prisoners, and at this stage it seems that it's the vast majority of prisoners, have gone on hunger strike. We're quite well aware of hunger strike in Ireland and the effects that it can have. Either as a preventative method or whatever, we're not really sure. I know the International Red Cross are very unhappy with the force feeding of some of the hunger strikers there. What would happen, or how badly could this escalate if somebody was to die?
Oh, I think it'll escalate substantially if someone is to die. It's already escalated substantially because of the hunger strikes. You know, before the hunger strikes started, it seemed like there was really no way forward on this issue. Congress, as I said before, had put these significant restrictions on the president's ability to do anything at Guantanamo. The president was not showing any inclination to challenge Congress in that regard. The courts, which are technically open to the detainees for habeas corpus proceedings, have not to this day ordered a single detainee released against the executive branch's will. And those cases have pretty much run out their course. And so it seemed entirely hopeless. And I think in large part because it seemed entirely hopeless, the detainees, a large number, over 100 of the detainees, have gone on hunger strike, and it's created a major embarrassment for the government. There are now 23 people, at least 23, who are being force-fed through their nose to keep them alive. And it creates this very, very bad image where we are holding these people indefinitely, possibly until they die, and yet when they say they want to die, we force-feed them in an incredibly painful process to keep them alive. I think it's done what the hunger strikers want to do, which was to put this issue back on the front pages, back on the front burner. I think that's what caused the question to be raised to President Obama. That's, I think, ultimately what motivated President Obama in his strong remarks. And I think, you know, with any luck, there will be some progress going forward. Despite Congress's restrictions, there are things the president could do. The Yemeni situation is an example. On the one hand, they've said they're not going to send anyone back to Yemen because the situation's unstable. But the question is that really a justifiable reason not to send them back? These are people who've been determined not to pose a threat that requires their detention. And yet we're not sending them back to their home country simply because we think their home country is too unstable. I think what we have to do in a situation like that is release them and then provide whatever assistance we think is necessary to ensure that Yemen can monitor their, them sufficiently to reduce the risk. We can't say because the political situation in Yemen is iffy, we're going to keep locking up people who we've determined we don't need to lock up.
Yeah. Okay, and how is this playing out with the American public, particularly force-feeding? How does that sit with the American public?
Well, I don't think it sits well with the American public, but I don't think the American public pays all that much attention either. That is, to the extent that they pay attention, it's troubling. But, query how much attention are they really paying? The detainees at Guantanamo are all foreign nationals. There's no Americans there. The Bush administration from early on made sure that there would be no Americans there. And so, you know, they can say to the American people in so many words, look, it's not your rights that are at issue here. It's somebody else's rights. It's their rights. And your rights aren't at stake. And, I think we see that with respect to drone strikes. Much more concern here when a drone is used to kill an American than when they're used to kill thousands of foreign nationals. And at Guantanamo, all you have is foreign nationals.
So it's not exactly a vote winner or a vote loser for Americans either way, is it?
Well, I think I think most Americans probably don't pay much attention. It is a loser for America in a much broader sense, and Obama understands that, and in fact said that at his press conference, that this is the continuation of Guantanamo's existence, given the kind of taint that he inherited from President Bush, in the way that people were treated there, and in the way that people were held there, and the like. Every day that Guantanamo remains open is a bad day for the United States in terms of its struggle for hearts and minds in the conflict with Al Qaeda and the Taliban.
Okay, so David, just before we let you go, at this stage, how realistically, when could we see it closing? What kind of time frame, and how would it happen?
I can't give you a time frame. Yeah. President Obama made a mistake in giving a time frame the first time around. Yeah. I do think that President Obama, is looking to his legacy. It's his second term, and he's not going to want to go out of office after serving two terms, failing to make good on a promise that he made on the first day in office. And so I do think you're going to see increased efforts to resolve this.
David Cole, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we wait and see really what will happen with Guantanamo at this stage, 11, 12 years that it's been running. It really is hard to know what would happen. As David Cole said himself, it would also be hard to see Obama going out of office having reneged or having not done anything about one of the main promises that he made going into office, which was the closing of Guantanamo. Yet how that is going to happen, how that's going to materialise, it's very hard to see really at this stage. But we wait and see, and we wait and hope at the very least that the hunger strikes could be brought to an end in some shape or form and see where we can go from there. Okay, so thank you very much to all of the guests today, to Mary Monteau from Burma Action Ireland. She was talking to us about the Buddhist attacks on Muslims in Burma, and of course that seems to be happening in Sri Lanka as well, but Mary was just talking to us about Burma. Greg Karlstrom from Al Jazeera was talking to us about the attacks on Syria, the Israeli bombardment of Syria of late. We had Michael Ratner from the Centre for Constitutional Rights and the US lawyer for Julian Assange, who was talking to us about Guantanamo. And then lastly, as you heard there, we had David Cole, Professor of Law at Georgetown University Law Centre, also talking to us about Guantanamo. So that's pretty much it from us for this fortnight. Up next is The Punk Show. I'm back with you again in 2 weeks' time at the same time, 3:30. So for me, Peter Carney, until then, take care.